Hello, everybody. I'm Robert Swarthout, and I'm joined here with Andres Sandate. We're the team behind Teton Crypto Capital. We thought before we start our first episode today, we might take a quick little few minutes here and introduce ourselves. I'm a software developer turned crypto fund manager. I've started and sold a few different software companies and decided I wanted to do something different about 3 years ago, and I've kind of made the transition into this world of running a fund. It's I'm really passionate about crypto, blockchain, and all the things that the fund invests in, and I'm happy to have a partner like Andres along with me for this journey, who has spent his career doing it. So I'll hand it off to Andres.
Hey, thanks, Robert. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. This is our first Crypto Weekly update. We decided to launch this show as a way to provide info and you know, analysis really on important crypto headlines. As Robert mentioned, I've spent my pretty much my entire professional career in the investment and asset management space, working at a number of different funds, and founded a company about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, called Endurance Strategies. And I run that to this day, and I provide advice and support around everything alternative assets. Robert and I started out working together a couple years ago, probably, right, Robert? And then I joined formally recently. And so, you know, crypto and everything digital assets is just such a fast moving space that we couldn't possibly cover everything in a 30-minute show, but we picked a few headlines, and I'm going to turn it back over to Rob. We picked a few key headlines. Robert has a deep background in this space, and I'm going to let him kind of tee up some topics that we're going to try to hit on, and I'm going to hopefully keep the show moving forward. I did wear my Kansas pullover, Robert, because, you know, today's Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the big dance got underway last night.
Yep.
And my Jayhawks are not favored to win at all this year. I think that, you know, goes to UConn and Houston. But who do you have before we jump into crypto? Who do you have winning it all in your bracket?
I don't do the brackets. So I may default back to colors or something silly to keep winning or flip a coin. Basketball is not my sport. If it's college football, maybe I'm a little more involved in that one. But not that
there you cool. go. Well, pick an SEC school because you're an SEC alum.
Florida's in it, so I'll pick Florida.
There you go. There you go. All right. Well, what do you have teed up for this inaugural show?
Yeah. So we're going to start with the SEC, and they've been in different lawsuits. I would say the biggest one that they're currently are in with Ripple. They're in the later stages of that case. It's largely been decided, but we're not going to talk about that case. We're going to talk about a case with DebtBox. And the SEC got itself in trouble here. This case has largely not been on my radar. I've kind of just seen it off in the distance. But what I found fascinating about this is the SEC got caught lying to the court.
Mm-hmm.
The court asked the SEC if they were sure that their statement was true. They said yes.
Yeah.
The court came back and basically said no and smacked them. Yeah. There's going to be a fine to the SEC, and the SEC and the charges are being dismissed by the judge. And the judge is not going to allow the SEC to refile the case. Huge loss. Yeah. I don't know what the real case was about, what the DebtBox case was about. But at the end of the day, it just shows that the SEC, to me, is the overreach that they're doing within the crypto space. They did it in the Ripple case, and they're obviously doing it here. They did it in something, another case called the Library case. Yeah, the Library case. That was silly. They basically just put a company out of business because they had the resources to do it, which is sad. But, you know, hopefully if we have a new administration that has a new view on crypto, we have some positivity that comes. But this is more of the same from the SEC, and it's just terrible for the industry. And, you know, admittedly, in some ways, I'm embarrassed to be an American these days with some of these actions.
Let me ask you a question. You know, there's been so much talk here of late because of ETFs and the massive inflows of capital, largely from individual investors into the 9 or 10 Bitcoin ETFs, which we're going to talk about that here in a minute. But let's spend some time here on this case. You know, a lot of folks who may not watch crypto outside of just the tokens that they own on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. When you look at the SEC's approach to the entire crypto space over the last 4 or 5 years, it's kind of been characterized by regulation through enforcement versus trying to get legislation passed in DC with the work of regulators and the crypto industry. What has that done? I want to ask you, as somebody who spends, you know, virtually all your time doing research, looking at crypto assets, mm-hmm. looking for projects that have promise and commercial utility. But what is that regulation by enforcement done, if you step back and look at the industry in terms of where mm-hmm. builders and crypto projects are starting?
In some ways, it's made it easier to do research because you don't have to pay attention within the U.S. because it's literally dried up. Everyone's left.
Has it?
That's a bit of an overstatement, but that's pretty much correct. You know, the teams are being advised to not do it in the U.S. if at all possible. You see, a lot of times you see Americans moving outside the U.S.
Yeah.
going to a jurisdiction like a Singapore, a U.K., maybe in Japan, and doing mm-hmm. something where the rules are laid out and it's a fair road, because it's, you know, to the SEC, they've got their hammer and they're looking for all the nails they can find. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's trying to protect the old guard. That's all it's about. It's not about innovation. It's not about protecting the investor, which they're doing the opposite of at this point, because they're putting, you know, retail investors at risk more than they should, because it's causing them to want to go offshore to buy things in jurisdictions where they don't have as much protection a lot of times.
And potentially going, you would, to take that one step further, you know, going to exchanges to buy tokens that those exchanges may, you know, I don't want to say they're like an FTX, but right. but because so much of this has had to go offshore, yeah. right? But there's just, people are going to transact in crypto. And I think there's mm-hmm. potentially camps of people who say this is just not real. It's a scam. It's all a fraud. And then there's folks that are like, no, I mean, I know somebody close to me is like, you know, owning Bitcoin's like owning real estate in Manhattan, you know, digitally. Right. And we could debate that, but the point is, it's not going away. There's a lot of folks that, right. that believe it's not going away. And the question is America, could America be the place where all this innovation is taking place, or are we going to lose out to other jurisdictions?
Yeah, you know, America certainly had could have had a first mover advantage. Mm. It's likely not a first mover advantage now, but we have such an advantage because this is the capital center of the world.
Right. Yeah.
So you would think that we would want to have some kind of influence over it, but right now it's currently just stick our head in the sand and pretend it doesn't exist approach. The cat's not going back in the bag. And at the end of the day, it's, you know, the world is borderless in the sense of the internet, and it's here to stay. So,
well, wrapping up this first topic. So for those on the live show, you know, look up DebtBox. You can go out on various platforms and news outlets, and if you search for DebtBox and the SEC, you can actually pull down the rulings. And to Robert's point, like it's pretty stark language that the judge used in their rulings. So let's talk about BTC and inflows in terms of these ETFs. So maybe you could give some context around how long have these, you know, exchange traded funds or ETFs, how long have they been around? How long has the, you know, the BTC taken to get to certain key milestones in terms of assets, and where's it going?
Yeah, it's it was highly anticipated. These ETFs launched January the 11th. To a good amount of fanfare. It was years in the making for some of the applicants and months for others. But at the end of the day, it's was a pretty important moment for the industry, because it's the first time you could buy crypto within a brokerage account and not be an accredited investor, because you would normally have had to have done like the Grayscale GBT trust. So there's 10 of these now. Grayscale did convert their trust into an ETF. And the first, I think it was the first 5 weeks, it was the fastest a single ETF had ever gotten $10 billion in
$10 billion. Yeah. And we're talking about BlackRock's.
BlackRock, yeah, yeah. The iShares BlackRock.
Which is IBIT, I believe.
Correct.
Yeah. So BlackRock being the, you know, one of the largest, if not the largest, after Vanguard, you know, it's probably depends on the product. And then you also have PowerShares, Invesco. Like, these are three gigantic asset management firms, global asset management firms that kind of lead the ETF race. So I'm curious to ask you, why did these get approved so quickly for some and take forever for other sponsors?
In hindsight, the crypto industry probably needed cleaned up. I don't think, I'm kind of the belief, had these big power players in finance not wanted Bitcoin ETFs, we would still not have them, even though we had other applicants that had already wanted them. They came along and they accelerated the process, in my opinion, of cleaning up the industry. The FTX stuff happened in late 22. That was going to happen no matter what.
Right.
But the cleaning up of Binance, I think, is definitely something that happened because these applicants, whether they had, they certainly didn't publicly say it, but it just seems way coincidental.
That happened so fast, right?
Oh, like, it went from being
settlement, everything. Yeah.
Doom and gloom, the settlement in November, and then all of a sudden super hype and rapid iteration of the S1s in December, even into the week of Christmas. They were working on these things, and then early January
So back to the ETF inflows or the capital coming into these products. So when you say that individual investors don't have to be accredited and they can buy them in a brokerage account, can you like explain what that means kind of basic layman's terms?
Yeah. So the Grayscale Trust had existed, I think, since 2017, 2018 timeframe, and it had $60 billion of AUM.
$60 billion.
Yeah, huge number. They had over 600,000 Bitcoin that they owned, which was, I think, the single largest holder outside of the founder of Bitcoin, Satoshi's wallet. So at the end of the day, it was, I wouldn't say it moved the market, but then there was a lockup when you were in the trust. So there was this whole narrative along with it, like, what kind of discount can you have because you have no liquidity effectively? And that went on for years. And that finally closed, obviously, when they got to convert. The flip side is when all these other nine came along, all of a sudden you could, you know, it's another ticker in your brokerage account. You could go buy it if the platform you're on supports it. Not all platforms currently support it. Vanguard is one. They decided that they're going to have the stance of it's not safe or whatever. I don't think they publicly say why they don't support it. They're just kind of like acting like it doesn't exist.
There's a lot of wirehouses. These wirehouses are the four big, you know, wealth management brokers. Mm-hmm. These would be firms like Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Wells Fargo, Citi. They are in, quote unquote, I would say, due diligence. They're reviewing it. They're monitoring it because, you know, the potential is once that's approved, you know, you could have advisors, you know, that could then call a client and say, hey, maybe we should do a 0.5%, 1%, 2% allocation. But isn't it true, though, that if the client's calling the advisor, potentially they may be able to sell them the Bitcoin at certain platforms?
It's certain platforms. Yes, correct. Certain platforms. That is the case. Well, not a Vanguard, but yeah.
Yeah.
Who do you think,
I want to ask you to speculate maybe, who is investing? I mean, how did these products get to $10 billion? What do you think the profile or avatar is of the investor that's, you know, putting dollars into these ETFs?
I think it is people that were already, I guess, on the edge of crypto news, kind of watching from the outside, didn't really have the ability or didn't have the interest to go open a Coinbase account. Or maybe they did and they just... It's easier. It's certainly less fees to go buy an ETF if you're versus going to Coinbase and buying Bitcoin. But you know, I kind of think the persona right now is a boomer that has money in the brokerage account and wants to take a bet on crypto. This is currently the only bet they can take within a brokerage account outside of some other accredited products.
They can kind of buy a proxy, though. I mean, they could invest in MicroStrategy, or they could invest in some of these other sort of stocks that give them exposure to blockchain technology or, you know, projects that are happening. But direct Bitcoin exposure, this is the more functional way.
And ironically, MicroStrategy, in my opinion, has turned into a leveraged hedge fund with regards to they only hold Bitcoin. And you're paying like 2x in basically no business behind. I mean, there is, but nothing at the scale that they're currently selling their shares at the PE ratio. So I don't know. It's been fascinating to watch because the flows in have all been inbound. It's, you know, we were, you know, it's in our notes here to talk about it. Kind of this next topic is like, there's functionally no one calling on their clients right now. Like, oh, would you like to add Bitcoin to your, I mean, I'm sure, but nothing of scale. It's all just pure, like, I want it, please put it in my portfolio. And, you know, and we think the price has run so far, and granted, we're in a bit of a pullback here. Not too surprising, but at the end of the day, when the spigot really gets turned on, this thing could get really interesting quickly.
Yeah. I'm curious to ask you before we move on to kind of the projections that the industry, we've seen some news come out that we want to react to about inflows into these products. It's safe to say that the current inflows so far into these ETFs have far exceeded even the most aggressive expectations from a lot of these, even from the issuers. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Because BlackRock had even mentioned that their goal for 2024 was to have $5 billion of AUM. They did that within the first probably 3 weeks. It's definitely accelerated for them. And, you know, now, you know, the kind of the consensus among issuers is it's going to be a basket, you know, all of them combined will be about $50 billion is what the current projections are.
I want to ask you from a professional investor's perspective. You know, you like I said, you are in this space day in, day out. Like, what are the ramifications or implications that you're paying attention to with respect to all this capital flowing into Bitcoin? We have a halving coming up next month,
right?
A Bitcoin halving. And a lot of people own Bitcoin that didn't own Bitcoin the last time there was a halving. Mm-hmm. You have all this money flowing in that's not even institutional capital yet. So right. I'm curious, what are the ramifications around mining and prices? And, you know, we're not a financial advisor. We're not a show to give advice, right? To be clear, I just would love to hear your thoughts on what you see kind of down the road.
Yeah, the idea that, one thing that I'm watching is just generally like how many Bitcoin are on exchanges slash some representation of what the volume is that's sitting at OTC desk. That is, I think, at around a 5-year high the last time I looked. It's going to be not high, low. Functionally approaching, I wouldn't say approaching zero, but pretty much that, you know, this is going to be pure, you know, supply and demand at some point. And it's kind of already showed itself, but as the price increases and certainly gets through a true all-time high, we've eclipsed the number that happened in 2021, but not inflation adjusted. That is I think like 78,000 or something like that. So we have a little bit ways to go. I mean, we're sitting at 64,000 today in a pullback that we're about, in my opinion, about halfway through. We're about 12% in. We probably should see around a 30% pullback before we kind of get to run again if it follows.
Because last week it touched 72, 73. I mean, these levels.
I think one day. Yeah. So you're talking like low 50s, 52 to 54 is kind of where we might, if we're following the last, the pattern of last cycles, you might kind of bounce off of and then you start going up.
That might be the new, that could be a new floor, right?
It's some level. Yes.
Yeah. At some level.
You know, again, this whole ETF, the capital coming in from the ETFs, does it blow up all the models from the past? I believe so. I see very few people that are talking about that. And, you know, people just purely speculating on price, which I guess is fun to do, but, you know, it's not grounded all that.
Yeah, well. That's one thing that I wanted to throw out there because, you know, we want to be a live weekly show about reacting to crypto news. And one thing you do not see in the news is you don't see any models or any like evidence-based kind of research, right, from anybody with a following that can justify why Bitcoin should go to X or Y. It's purely more, it feels more like a FOMO driven rally.
This whole market's FOMO driven. There's, you know, fund focuses on commercial utility. There's very little utility right now, admittedly. Maybe the sprouting of some, but it's still,
but that doesn't sell newspapers.
Correct.
And that doesn't get clicks.
And
people want to hear about what MicroStrategy is doing and they want to hear about how much BlackRock has raised today. And that's what's generating a lot of news. And you're now seeing you know, these Bitcoin tickers that are showing up on, you know, the major, you know, financial news networks. It's just changed quickly, but there's really not a lot of depth to a lot of the analysis and reporting.
Right. So FOMO, and then kind of tying it back to one of your other questions about the halving that's coming up, you know, so roughly every 4 years, the number of Bitcoin that's produced on a daily basis gets cut in half. It's called the halving. It's part of the code of Bitcoin. Yep. It's functionally written in stone. And it's going to go from currently 900 a day to 450. Bitcoin will be mined all the way to the year 2140, assuming the network's still around. And at that point, it'll no more new Bitcoin be created. But at this point, something like, I think 85% of all Bitcoin has been created, or some very high number of the 21 million. But, you know, I think at some level, this halving is more of a psychological event than it is a real pricing event, because, you know, these ETFs are consuming 10,000 plus Bitcoin a day on any given day at this point. And then you're changing the supply from 900 to 450. That doesn't materially change. It's the sellers for those ETFs to be able to buy are coming from the current float. It's not coming from the miners. If we were doing this 8 years ago, it probably would be material. Not so much now.
Right. So what you're saying there, I want to break that down. You're saying that the seller that is willing to transact and sell their Bitcoin ultimately to these ETF issuers who need to buy because they've got capital to put to work is not the miner. It is float that's out in the marketplace. It's people that have Bitcoin in their wallet already.
Right. And you know, I guess to be clear, the miners could be, I guess, also speculators. They could have been holding some Bitcoin for some period of time, but they have cost, real cost involved. So I think that is a mixture, but to satisfy the demand that's happening from the buying of the ETFs, there has to be other sellers outside of the miners. Yeah. And, you know, longtime holders and, you know, the all-time high is interesting. It's been kind of bumping its head against that. And then we've pulled back a little bit. So maybe there's other stuff going on. Also, you can kind of watch the Bitcoin futures are being absolutely manipulated every single day when it comes to, it's almost like the futures drives down the price. So the ETFs can come in and buy at a slight discount. And you've kind of seen this, I wouldn't say tug of war, but definitely this nudging of the price that happens. So it's fascinating.
Well, it is. And we could spend the entire half hour talking just about Bitcoin and ETFs, but there's other news. There's other things that are happening. What else caught your attention this year? Or pardon, this week? Feels like it's been a year.
You know, actually just today, you know, it's early. So trying to be not super speculative on this, but the Ethereum Foundation is got some kind of investigation going on by some state entity. It's not clear to me whether that's US based or some foreign based. I've said to many people that I think that the Ethereum Foundation or some entity that Consensus or Ethereum Foundation, so one of those two seems to be next for the SEC to sue. There's a lot of smoke there. More smoke than any other case that I've seen come up. And it's, I don't know, some bad folks seem to be involved with it. I'm not necessarily cheering for the blowing up of Ethereum, because that would be not a good event for crypto as a whole.
Right. Right.
But maybe
especially when a lot of people that are watching these, you know, ETFs, Bitcoin ETFs, when they're on these shows and when they're in the news, that they're always asked, what's next? Everybody wants to know what's next. And everybody's talking about, okay, there's going to be, you know, an Ethereum token an Ethereum ETF next. So important.
I think people should focus and listen to Larry Fink a little bit more on this one. When he says tokenization is what's coming next, I think that's what the North Star should be. I think people should be less focused on an Ethereum ETF. It will happen at some point, but tokenization is a much bigger topic that is more broadly reaching, that has real use case in the world rather than just another way to speculate on some crypto.
Yeah. Let's talk about what some news. There's a lot of news around RWA, real world asset tokenization, as it's called in the industry. And we could go down a bunch of different lanes here from the standpoint of what gets tokenized to different projects and companies around the world, not even ones in the US that are actually tokenizing infrastructure, like the types of assets that BlackRock just acquired through their major asset management purchase of one of the leading infrastructure firms. So maybe talk a little bit about the news and the headlines there to help folks listening or that will watch understand why should, you know, we be paying attention to RWA?
Yeah, I guess it's super high level. I'm a big believer that you're going to end up being, you end up using a crypto platform behind the scenes as something that's tokenized before you realize you're actually using it. It is a back office mechanism that at first, a cost saving mechanism, whether it's tokenizing of a fund, a tokenizing of a real estate project, a tokenizing of, you know, this equities. I mean, there's all sorts of places that this can show up. I think it's certainly going to show up in places offshore for the US first, and then due to lack of regulation will come on shore later. And maybe that's good. I don't know. Time will tell, because maybe the first iteration of the technology needs to kind of be worked through, the bugs get worked out, or kind of figure out what the right fit is and then kind of use it for something that's a little more
internal. Right. I mean, because when you look at our securities laws, they go back to 33 and 34, right? And and things have changed, obviously, to say the very least, over the last 80, 90 years. So, and when you talk about tokenization, it raises a significant number of issues from not just regulation, compliance, but legal, ownership, right? We've talked about some of those things practically. And again, you hear in the news cycle a lot about, oh, we're going to tokenize this multifamily asset, or we're going to tokenize this industrial building, but there's really less meat around how's this going to work, who's doing it, when's it going to happen?
Yeah, you know, it's early days, right? I mean, like in some ways, people don't even know how the technology is going to get used. They're trying to find ways to, you know, in some ways, I wouldn't say a technology looking to solve a problem, but that's kind of what it is. So it's, you know, just like the early days of the internet, like how would the internet be used? And we use it in a million different ways we didn't realize then. So,
well, let me ask you as we wrap up, because we want to be respectful of our goal to jam pack this show in 30 minutes. When somebody that is wanting to learn and get educated and follow what's breaking in terms of news around digital assets and crypto, what are some of the sources, you know, because there's so much hype out there, there's so much trash. What are some of the things that somebody like yourself, like a professional investor, is looking at, whether that's people you follow or just outlets that tend to have a more, you know, sober, realistic, kind of measured approach to it?
Yeah, there's probably two I'll mention. One, the Wall Street Journal has I believe a weekly email newsletter that they send out that's crypto focused. You can find that. It's, you know, relatively well done. They've gotten a lot better, admittedly. And I guess the second one is going to come from the group Consensus that I talked about in the Ethereum thing. But they do a newsletter that I believe that you get that is maybe a little bit more investor professional focused and kind of tries to cut out all the crap that happens in crypto and crypto.
And, yeah, I think what you're referring to is the weekly newsletter that I get that's targeted at financial advisors. And so as an advisor, I read that because I think it breaks down a lot of the projects and terminology and things that an advisor would likely be asked by a client and trying to convey it in a way, not to sell something, but just to explain these are things that are happening in this growing asset class to be mindful of, because there are advisors that have written off crypto and written off, you know, owning Bitcoin. And yet, last data point, BlackRock reports that there is $10 billion in held away assets, which means assets not being managed by advisors. You can find this on their website, $10 billion in held away assets by high net worth investors. So that's a lot of assets, like to your earlier point in the show, that are being, you know, self-managed. And I think that newsletter is really good. Okay, you get the final word.
Well, I just want to thank everyone for joining us on this inaugural session and look forward to catching up with everybody on a weekly basis.
Sounds great. Thank you, everybody.
See you.
Take care.